Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everyone. Today, our guest is Lily King. Thanks for joining us here on The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Lily is the author of Five Tuesdays in Winter, which will be released on November 9th by Grove. Her first novel, a while ago, was The Pleasing Hour, followed by The English Teacher, then Father of the Rain and Euphoria. And then we spoke to Lily last March at the beginning of when we were beginning to hunker down about Writers and Lovers, which is great. And everything, all her books have won tons of awards. Her writing has also appeared in Washington Post, the New York Times, and lots of anthologies. So today, as we're speaking about Five Tuesdays, we'll also once again be peripherally talking about Writers and Lovers without a capital. So Five Tuesdays in Winter brings together in 10 different tales a lot of what we all live, we all experience: fathers and mothers, love and loss, death and illness, serendipitous happiness coupled with beauty and peace, fear, surprise, horror, delusion, even though that could be an awkward introduction to the vast majority of books, excluding cookbooks or something. But okay. In any event, welcome, Lily, and thanks so much for being willing to talk with me again.
Oh, thanks so much, Sam. So good to be here.
So since I own a bookshop, I always start out this way. And I always say the same thing. Everyone tells you can't judge a book by its cover, but every single person who comes into a bookstore judges every book by its cover. So if you have it there, just hold it up so we can see.
I do. This is just the galley, so it's not the beautiful, beautiful hardcover. So the colors aren't quite as great. But this is my favorite book of all the books that I have published in terms of the physical thing, because this is a detail from a painting that my mother-in-law did that we own that's down in our living room. And it's an incredibly gorgeous, gorgeous painting. And then I can't show it to you because I don't have the copy, but my younger daughter, Eloise, did the author photo, and my older daughter, Calla, did these little drawings that are, you know, just under the title of every story. And so it's really like, it's a family book, and I just love it so much.
Yeah, I think when people read it, it's abstract, which is different. Mm-hmm. So you have to kind of, but the colors, well, and I will really enjoy seeing the full colors. I think that'll be really cool.
It's really spectacular.
Well, okay, so next I usually like to talk about epigraphs, but short story books don't usually have them, and this doesn't.
You have one.
And it's really interesting how in the story, you know, some people love novels and some people love short stories, but there's people, you know, it's not usually the same, you know? But with you, this is your first collection?
It is. I mean, you know, like most writers, I got started with a short story in high school, actually, and wrote them straight through college and grad school. So I feel like they're sort of still a more familiar form to me than the novel. And so they've been kind of accumulating on my computer for years and years. And I finally decided to pick my favorite 10 and put them in a book.
Well, that's a good segue into the first story, which is Creature, because the protagonist there has a diary, a very emotional diary. And I thought, I wonder if Lily did that when she was younger or not. Did you?
Yes. Yep. A diary. I was a big letter writer. My mother's big thing all my life was, don't write anything that you don't want to see on the front page of the Boston Globe. Like, that's what she told me all my life, way before she thought that I was going to be a writer, you know, but I never took that advice. And it definitely got me into trouble. My journals were found, my letters were found. I had some uncomfortable moments of people finding things. And so I definitely drew on that for that story and the position that it puts her in.
Was it as over the top as this one was?
No, thank God. The consequences were not as dire by any means, thank God. But it was fun to just kind of play out a different scenario, you know, what could have happened.
Yeah, I thought a lot about you in a couple of those stories, because there's two stories that deal essentially with babysitters, two very different stories.
True.
And so did you babysit too and drew from that a little bit?
Growing up, I had a lot of babysitters, and then I became a babysitter at a very early age and continued to babysit. I think my last babysitting job, you know, apart from my own children, was when I was like 32 or something. And I was so broke, as always. I mean, I was just always broke. And I was living in California, and I had been living with a boyfriend in Palo Alto in a little cottage, and we broke up, and I could not afford. I was working at a used bookstore, so you can imagine my salary, and teaching kind of on the side SAT prep. And I could not afford anything. And this is, you know, this is before Palo Alto became what it is now. But, right. And so I saw an advertisement, and I took an apartment at the side of a house in Portola Valley, California. And my rent was paid for if I took care of the two kids kind of in some evenings, you know, per week. And, you know, I was in my 30s by then. So I was like always babysitting. And I think I have a lot to say about babysitting.
I know, it was funny because you know how her name is mispronounced by the wealthy woman. And I remember when my daughter started babysitting when she was like 13 or 14, and she babysat for this really rich family. So when it time to get paid, the woman would say, "Oh, you know, I have to wait. I only have hundreds." And then she wouldn't pay her.
Terrible. I remember getting a quarter an hour, and that was, those people were really wealthy. Like I had never gotten a quarter an hour before. I mean, that's pathetic, but yeah, it's a funny thing.
Quarter an hour. That's I can understand that.
I mean, it got me a lot of candy bars because they would stay out for a long time. And, you know, and then I would just, it was all about candy bars for a long time for me.
What's your favorite candy bar?
That at the time, I think a Heath bar or a $100,000 bar.
$100,000 bars are okay, but I hate Heath bars.
Oh, what about Score bars? Really? Truly?
Yes, because they're like, I don't like caramel or butterscotch or toffee or any of those things.
Oh my God, that's like my most favorite flavors in the whole world.
They suck. Three Musketeers is good because it's fluffy, not stuffy. That's what you want, is fluffiness.
No, yuck. Except that I've recently discovered the Three Musketeers Midnight with dark chocolate. Unbelievable. Changes everything.
Ooh, that could be a big thing for me. Yeah. That could be the most important thing that's happened to me all day.
Unless I tell you about the dark chocolate Kit Kat that I discovered just yesterday.
I got those before you, I think.
Those are pretty amazing.
Because Kit Kat is actually my favorite. Kit Kat and of course Reese's, which now,
oh yeah,
this is what I do. I end up talking and then we don't sell your book at all.
That's okay. We can sell some Reese's cups. I'm happy with that.
Well, you started it with the candy bars. So we have, well, you tell a little bit about the story and then I have one question I want to ask about it.
Okay. About Creature.
Yeah.
So I really, when I started writing this book, this story, I wasn't really sure I knew where it was going, but it's about a 14-year-old girl whose father keeps going to rehab for drug use and the parents keep breaking up and getting back together and they don't have much money. And she, the mother is a seamstress in town and one of her clients is an older woman. And the older woman finds out she has a daughter and gets her to come to her basically mansion, kind of on the point. They live on a seaside town outside of Boston for a week when her daughter is coming with her two children, her two young children. And so she shows up and, you know, there's a butler and there's a maid and there's a cook. And, you know, it's a very, very, very fancy, totally different environment that she's used to. And she doesn't really know who is who, and she's really scrambling to put it all together. But she gets up to her third floor room, and it inspires her. It changes her. And she's reading Jane Eyre, and she's up in this, you know, room with a turret, and she starts writing letters to her friend. And unbeknownst to me, she says that she eventually becomes a writer. And that line was so exciting to me because I had no idea that's where we were going. And this is before I wrote Writers and Lovers, and I'd never ever written about anyone being a writer before. And it was very surprising and exciting and kind of, you know, for me, new ground. And I really enjoyed where that went with her and the voice. It changed her voice when I realized that about her.
Yeah, it's interesting that, in my opinion, you intersperse yourself as a writer throughout this whole book.
Yeah.
Boys.
Yeah, there are three, you know, we kind of separated them. At first we thought maybe we put them all together, but then they're like the three pillars of the book that kind of hold it up, are these three stories in which the narrator, the female narrator, you learn that she's a writer at different phases of a writing career.
Hey, has anyone ever told you that you write a lot about lousy, missing, or suicidal fathers?
probably suicidal. Yeah.
He was. Yeah.
It's true.
That's why they went to the Word On. Yeah.
Oh, true. Forgot about him. It's true. And in Father of the Rain, there was a little.
I love when I remind writers of something they've written and they've forgotten. You know.
Yeah. I really have to read this over. Before I go on my book tour, I have got to read it. That's on my to-do list.
So my favorite story. So already on YouTube, there's one blogger who talks about your book. So there's one up already.
Oh, wow. How exciting.
And she's British. And she goes, I was a little puzzled because I thought there'd be five stories because it says five Tuesdays. But there are more. She goes, but there are many more. She goes, I don't know how many.
That's really funny.
I bet you're going to get that again, though.
Oh, it's just five Tuesdays, not five stories.
So one of the reasons I like it, first of all, I own a bookshop. I'm talking about five Tuesdays in winter. I own a bookshop. It's such a happy story. Mm. And she's so lovely. And he's such a good man. And his daughter is so funny. And also because I treat my customers way worse than he.
That's pretty bad then.
Oh, it's horrible. I've asked them to leave. I've told them if they leave, I'll give them $20.
No.
Seriously. You know, that's just.
What have they done to make you force them to leave?
Well, generally, most Republicans I'll ask to leave.
And how do they give that away? Are they wearing their MAGA hat? What are they doing?
Well, no, it's that when they ask, it's a coffee shop too. So when they ask for a non-fat, half-calf, decaf, you know, I said, you have to order your coffee in three words or less.
Oh, you would hate my husband.
What does he get?
He orders a decaf he has some precise, sometimes he's like with 1/5 or 1/6 calf, and then just a little splash of milk, not too much, just a little stain of milk, you know, like, oh my God, I refuse to buy him a cup of coffee.
Oh, that's like Larry David on Curb Your Enthusiasm last year goes, yeah, look at this. It's coffee and it's milk. What a great idea. And also, so the other thing is my partner used to be an employee at my bookstore, and we've been together for 7 years, and she's just as beautiful inside and outside as Kate.
Wow.
Very similar. We didn't know. It was like back and forth. And then one day I thought, oh, you know, and.
Wow. That's, and does she still work there?
No, but she'll be the one who's editing this interview.
Okay.
Her name is Carrie. And I also have a Kate working for me now too.
Oh, okay.
The cool thing about my employees is that they're all as irascible as me. So, and I've never really hired anyone, and you may know this, like, but people just kind of fall into bookstores.
Yeah.
And then they ask if they can work there.
Yeah.
So I've never really actually hired anyone. And yeah, and if someone doesn't fit, you know right away, you know, immediately they don't fit. So
yeah, it is. It's so interesting. It's so interesting. When I go into bookstores now, I mean, I used to work at a lot of them, but now I go into them and you can feel, you know, you can, you can feel the personality of the kind of composite, the composite of all of the, you know, people who work there. Like you just feel it.
Yeah. And it's like me and my dad. My dad basically just called me a jackass all my life. And it took me like 20 years of therapy to realize he was saying, I love you.
So
that's the way we are, you know, and then that story is the same way, the way he treats his daughter, you know, it's like he's yelling at her, but but love is inside the yelling, you know?
Yeah. 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 I can't think of when he yells at her though. I feel like he's more silent and kind of.
Actually, you even mentioned Mary Tyler Moore in your book.
Yeah, I do. In Creature, yeah.
I was thinking of Lou Grant and how he said that Mary was spunky. And he goes, I hate spunk.
Right.
Like that.
Yeah. No, it's true.
But then when you read phrases or sentences like melted flakes glinted like stars all over her, you go, wow, this is a really good story.
Oh, thank you.
You know, that says so much and just how 7 words or whatever, you know, I mean, and that's what everything boils down to is things like that, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, William Carlos Williams said no ideas, but in things, you know?
Right. What's the poem?
So Much Depends Upon.
I know. Yeah. A red wheelbarrow. Glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens.
Exactly.
This is my favorite poem of all time.
So it's so funny, isn't it? Because you run across it usually in high school or something and you're kind of like, well, that's stupid, you know? And it looks so funny on the page compared to all the other poems. And man, does that stick with you along with the plums, you know, the note on the refrigerator about the plums. I mean, but that's what he meant. Like those details, so much depends upon those nouns, you know, those details. And it's really true. I've just been writing this essay about Shirley Hazard's The Evening of the Holiday. And it's all, the whole thing hangs on these physical objects in this book that just, you know, that just carry all this emotion. And I just find that really fascinating.
Well, first of all, I think it's like, I agree with everything you're saying, but it's not really that so much depends. It's like, everything.
Yeah.
And the thing is, how can you see the wheelbarrow and the word glaze does so much, but I mean, how can you actually see everything? It's just a few words, but you can see the whole thing. You can see the chicken stand. I mean, you can entire pictures in your mind, but he didn't say anything really. But anyway.
Yeah, no, it's so true. It's so true.
Two more things about that story. I just came back from my daughter's house I just came back from Florida last night and I was at her husband's office and a guy named Stan came in who knew Katie, another Kate.
Okay.
And he looked at me and he goes, he didn't even say hello. He goes, you two have exactly the same eyes. And then he left.
Oh, that's so funny.
I know. And I thought, you know, that's the kind of guy I would hire.
Right.
and it's funny because I knew I was going to be interviewing you today. That was yesterday. And that's when
that is so bizarre.
It is.
Yeah. Yeah. For those of you who haven't read it, that's a line in the book.
You know, that's the other thing I do is I talk about stuff that they haven't read yet. So there's no way this is not going to be a profitable interview for you monetarily.
It's okay. I don't do it for the money.
If I own a bookstore, I definitely do not do it for the money. Trust me. I also like the way his daughter, you know, and this kind of pissed me off at first because it's like, okay, there's the moment like it would be in a movie, you know, when she says fear, desire, love.
Oh, right.
And then they're moving in and then she comes in and separates them. I go, no. It's... But then it's so nice the way she leads them holding both of their hands and the chocolates. And so it all, you know, it'll all work. We know it's all going to work out great.
Yeah.
So that, forever and ever. But not all your stories are like that.
No, I was going to say that's definitely a happy ending story.
That's a really good story. Not like in a Hallmark kind of way, but it's really good.
No, there's definitely hope there though. Yeah.
And then if you move on to another one that for most of it is really happy, one in the Dordogne.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And another babysitting story.
Yeah, I know. So, very, very different. The babysitters are college age boys.
And talk a little bit about how they changed this little kid's life for the better.
Well, it's a funny story because I came to the idea of it when I ran into this kid. I mean, you know, wasn't a kid anymore, but I knew him when I was a kid, when we were like 15 years old or something. And I hadn't seen him in years and years and years. And this was years ago. And our kids were little and we were at a pizza place and we ran into this guy I just talked to him for 5 minutes, like, hey, how are you doing? And I don't know why he said this, but we were talking about something. And he said, oh yeah, when I was in high school, my parents went away for the summer and they hired two college kids to take care of the house. And because I came with the house, they had to take care of me too. And I just thought it was such an interesting way of putting that and kind of revealing the neglect very, very quickly. And that really stuck with me for several years. And then finally one day I just started writing it. I don't know why. And then I don't know anything about his father, his mother, his childhood, anything, or the college boys. I just made it all up. But it was just that, and I came with the house, that really grabbed me. And so it's about somebody who's really been, he's like a martini baby, you know, he came along much later, not anticipated and not really wanted. So his parents are much older, and his older brothers and sisters have long moved out of the house, and he's 14, and these two college kids arrive and they give him kind of the care and the nurturing that he has needed, you know?
Yeah, and it's nice. I wish when I was that age, especially with regard to girls, I wish I had someone who had my back,
yeah,
to allow me to understand how to speak to someone that I was attracted to and make it so easy. And then in your story, someone that you're still attracted to decades after.
Spoiler alert.
Oh, sorry. I could take that's. I was going to even say something else, but what can I say? Basically, the moment you're introduced to happiness or something.
Yeah. Like that. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Without spoiling. So something about the relationship between Grant and Ed also foreshadows a different type of relationship later on, too.
Yeah,
Which is not good. So the next one is North Sea and Hannah and Oda. Is that how you pronounce it?
Oda. Yeah, Oda. I don't know. I'll have to Google that.
That's the problem when I research for these things. I start going down the rabbit hole for everything. And hours later, I come up.
I know.
Talk a little bit about that one, because if I say anything to spoil that, you'll kill me.
Well, that one is about a mother and a daughter, and they are German, and they're going to the North Sea for a vacation. And the husband / father has recently died. And so they're both really grieving, and they go to the sea and they have, you know, a pretty tough time because they're both grieving the same person, but they can't grieve together, and they can't seem to give each other the comfort that they need. And, you know, they stay in this little B&B and meet some people, and it's really just kind of about their relationship and this teenage girl who just is resisting her mother's concern and care, you know?
Yeah. I do really want to spoil it, but I can't.
Well, we'll just say it's very tense and lots happens and you should read it.
Yeah. There's one word, but another missing father.
Yeah. True.
I never would have left the suitcase there. I am so obsessive compulsive. There's no way I could have let that suitcase sit there.
That was very strong of her. Yeah.
I couldn't do it. There's no way. Plus in the last week, I've lost my glasses. I lost my coat. Now I don't want to wear my glasses because I put them here when I'm out using them. So I won't wear my glasses because I'm afraid I'm going to lose them. So I won't use them. My mother had a condo in Boca Raton, and she never used the dishwasher once because she thought if she used it, it might break.
Oh, that is very funny. Well, let me tell you, dishwashers really break a lot, and they're really annoying. We just got a new one, and it's already broken. But the thing is, so you just don't get very expensive glasses. Like, my husband orders them, you know, like 10 in a pack or something for whatever, $15. He breaks on them, you know. They're in our bed. They're everywhere.
Yeah, well, reading glasses. I'd get them at the dollar store. But now they have this new company, Warby Parker, that just went on the stock market. And their glasses, is that what you're wearing?
Yep.
That's what I should be doing.
These are fake Warby Parkers because I have real ones. But when I'm doing this, you know, I don't need my glasses because I'm nearsighted. And so, but I don't like not wearing glasses. So I just got some fake ones.
That's so funny. I just read an article about that, how for Hollywood, glasses are an accessory. You know, even if you don't need them, they're still an accessory that can be utilized in so many ways, but it's just glass. Okay, timeline. So this is my favorite in specifically one sense, two words, Ethan Frome, because I hated that book so much.
I think many people hated that book.
Why did you like it or did you hate it and why?
No, I read it probably when I was 30 or 31. I actually read it in Portola Valley in that little apartment at the side of the house. And I needed a comforter. And so our comforter cover, like a duvet cover. And so I bought two sheets with a pretty pattern and I sewed them together. And while I sewed them by hand, like, you know, a double bed kind of comforter, I listened to, you know, a book on tape that I'd gotten out of the library of Ethan Frome. And I loved it. But I love everything that I listen to and am doing something with my hands. You know, that is like a huge pleasure of mine. So Ethan Frome, I did love, but it, and I never had to read it in high school, but I know a lot of people did. And it just, of a certain era, you know, it's just, it's kind of what you read and hated. And also just so, so depressing. It gives such a grim view of marriage, of winter, of sledding, of sacrifice, you know, and why you give high school kids this, no one reads it anymore, but this incredibly, incredibly gloomy glimpse into the future. I don't know, but.
Yeah, the thing about it is, I mean, yeah, I like Edith Wharton and the writing is excellent. The idea at the end though, like, to get on that sled and aim for the, and then you don't die, but everything gets screwed up and you could have just gotten up and walked. You know, you could have just left and leave her there. I mean, because.
Exactly.
Yeah, but then I kept, the reason I don't like it is because I realize when people have fears, if they can't overcome them, you can't make them overcome them. It's like people who are depressed and then you say to them, why can't you just be happy?
Yeah, well, yeah.
You know, what kind of thing is that to say?
Yeah, no, it's true. And you make, you know, and in this case, you just make just terrible warps.
Yeah, and Ethan loved her as much as your bookshop owner loved Kate. Hmm. And they could have just walked away and had a wonderful, wonderful life. But
yeah. I guess given the time and, you know.
Yeah. So it really was a good book. It's just that, yeah, I hate it. Yeah, and also because of the Ethan Frome thing, it's the story is almost like an old slapstick comedy, you know, movie in a way. Especially when they're running.
It is kind of there are just a lot of absurd elements in that story. Yeah.
Especially when they're running around the kitchen table.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
All right, so you tell a little bit about the story. I always do this, damn.
Well, It's about a young woman. It's the middle writer story where the character is a little bit older, out of college, and kind of at loose ends, and is moving in sort of temporarily with her brother and his girlfriend in Vermont. And the one thing the brother says is, just don't talk about Ethan Frome. And he means in front of his girlfriend, because his girlfriend is a little threatened by the education that they've had, and that their kind of feelings about literature and their connection through literature, and it intimidates her. And for her, for this girlfriend, obviously she was assigned Ethan Frome as a high school kid. And for her, Ethan Frome like represents kind of the literary canon that she feels shut out of, and that she's not interested in, and that is threatening to her for whatever reason, and a different side of him that she can't relate to and doesn't want other people to relate to. And so, of course, you know, that's a very tempting thing when you're not, it would never occur to this narrator to talk about Ethan Frome. She hasn't even read Ethan Frome, but now, of course, all she wants to do is talk about Ethan Frome.
It's like whoever said, Pirandello or someone, that if you see a gun in act one, you know it has to go off.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
So
yeah.
I knew she was going to do it. I knew she had to do it. And that could be made into a really nice little movie. It's so cinematic, right? Especially that last scene.
Mm.
And then,
yeah.
Then,
yeah, yeah.
And then her brother, you know, at first I wasn't thinking he would be that cool. And then it was like back and forth. And then at the end, when he's trying to save the girl's kids, yeah, and all, and they're running down the street after the, you know, it is very cinematic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's really a story about, you know, how she feels like she knows her brother and she likes certain things about him, which is kind of his wit and his edginess and his intelligence. And she's really confused because his girlfriend thinks that he's really sweet and kind. And she's just like, what? You know, that hasn't been my experience. And then living with them, you know, she sees this whole other side, this whole other part of her brother's humanity that being in their family hasn't really allowed her to see. And that's what that's about.
Yeah. And you got lots of interesting, let's call them love interests in that story too.
Yeah. 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 That was fun. That was a little bit of a precursor to Writers and Lovers, you know?
Yeah.
You know, she's got a waitressing job and, she's a writer.
Yeah, you had a lot of guys in that story. And William was such a, you get these, I don't know where you find someone like William.
I had so much fun with William, though. Oh, my God. Loved him.
I bet. I can just see you thinking, especially when she goes to the wedding. You know, it's just.
Yeah.
Why would he? And Jeb too.
I know. Jeb is great.
Yeah.
Jeb is
great. And it's funny because the writer says about, you know, sometimes you can just put these words together and all of a sudden you have a 3-minute story. Mm. A second. I wonder if you're talking about, were you talking about yourself?
I'm sure I was talking about, you know, just, yeah. You're talking about what she does is she gives a, she's hated at the wedding, right? She's been the worst maid of honor ever. And you know, she shows up late and somebody else has had to take on all of her duties and she has no money. So she can't give like a little bridesmaid present that you're supposed to, and she hates the dress and she just thinks it's all bullshit. And then she, you know, they hate her and she knows it and they have like nicknames for her and everything. And then they go to the reception and she has to give a toast. And so she just tells the story about like her friend's dog dying or something. And everybody's in tears. And like, you know, it's taken her like 3 minutes to deliver this tiny little story. And then everybody loves her, you know? And so that's when she, you know, says, wow, you know, you can really affect people just with a little tiny story and like change everybody's mind. And so she's kind of a little high on the power of words and of story and narrative and that sort of thing.
Little Miss, look who showed up.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, and the other thing was good in that story was the brother and sister talking about the little guy with, his name is Wooly Willy, the toy,
Oh, yeah. I remember looking that up.
Yeah, my brother and I used to play it all the time.
Oh,
that one and Operation. Remember Operation?
Yes. That was a little too scary for me. I didn't like the buzzer. I thought I was going to get electrocuted every time the buzzer went off.
You wouldn't be able to do that now, make that toy.
It's true. It was a little twisted for little kids.
Yeah, it's like Dan Aykroyd in Saturday Night Live when I forgot what salesman it was selling bags of crushed glass to kids.
Oh, that's so funny. Well, do you remember, I've been thinking about this lately. Did you ever have a rabbit's foot?
Yes.
I mean, rabbit's feet were good luck, right? You can buy them anywhere.
Oh, yeah.
I had a rabbit's foot. I used to like, it was so soft. The fur was so soft and the bone, you could feel it right through. And I used to rub it against my cheek. What the fuck? That was a fucking rabbit's foot.
My favorite New Yorker cartoon, and it's a card, and I sell it. I literally hand sell it to anyone who's looking for any card for any occasion. It's this father rabbit and son rabbit sitting on a bench waiting for a train. The son's obviously going to war, to college, or somewhere like that. And the father reaches into his pocket and he takes out this rabbit's foot and he gives it to the son. He goes, here, your mother wanted you to have this. It's her lucky foot. But it's, I'll send it to you. I'll send you a card.
Very funny. That's very funny. Oh my God.
So now moving from comedy to tragedy, which would be Hotel Seattle.
Oh yeah, that's a tough one.
I think it's a situation that more people find themselves in than you might think.
Yeah, no, that's probably true. Although I hate to think of that, but yeah.
Yeah, talk about that one a little bit.
Well, it's about two men. One is the narrator, and he gets a call from his college roommate. And the narrator is gay and living with his partner, and kind of, he's been a little bored. You know, it's his first boyfriend, and he's kind of stayed with him through various moves and keeps thinking that, you know, maybe they'll break up, and then they don't. And anyway, he gets this call from his college roommate who he had always had this huge crush on, but who was straight. And he says, I'm coming into town, you know, do you want to have a drink? And so he goes, and I don't want to give too much away, but they have a very, very disturbing, intense encounter. What I think for me most powerful about that story is the end and what happens with our narrator's relationship, you know? And I was surprised by that. I didn't know that was going to happen. And I feel like for me, that's what I really hold on to with that story is the ending.
You mean Maurice says that Stevie had the wisdom of an old man?
Yeah. Yeah, with Steve, yeah.
Yeah, that's not giving anything away.
No.
But that was...
He didn't say wisdom, no, he said of God. Hold on.
Oh, no, you're right. He said he was older, but he said he was older.
Yeah, he was older. But yeah, there's that line. He was older than me and wise as God.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, but that was... the reason why that's important in talking to you as a writer is because you do that. You think something's going somewhere, which it kind of is, but then something comes sideways.
Yeah. Really love that in when I read. I love that so much. And so when it happens, when you're writing, you're so happy. It's nothing you aim for. It just happens. And
well, with some writers, you're not with Franz Kafka, but I don't think he was that happy when he wrote Metamorphosis.
I bet he was. I bet he was like, he was like, this is the perfect metaphor.
He wrote it in one night. He must have been miserable the entire time. But
I don't know. I bet he was psyched. God, I'd be psyched if I were writing that story.
If it wasn't for Max Brod, we wouldn't even have it because he broke a dying man's promise.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, Franz Kafka made Max Brod promised to burn every single thing he had ever written.
Oh.
And instead, Max, otherwise we wouldn't have the trial or America or the castle or Metamorphosis. So the moral compass question is, do you keep the promise or do you give the world confidence?
Yeah, no, you don't keep the promise.
Right. But anyway, so now you're Kafkaesque, but you're not Kafkaesque.
No.
But that sideways thing is good, because like the way you were explaining it, and I'm not giving away anything, the way you're saying it moves forward towards a very disturbing and violent, whatever, conclusion, and that's where you're going as a reader. It's a train track. You're just going straight in that way. And then all of a sudden, hey, that's not what it's about.
Yeah.
That guy's got his own problems.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And then another story that you would think would be, and this one I can't give away at all, but it's Waiting for Charlie.
Mm.
And it's really sad, but it's also really happy.
Mm.
The way I read it. And it's short.
Yeah, it's just about an old man who goes to visit his granddaughter in the hospital, and his granddaughter's in a coma. And the nurse asks him to try some aromatherapy. And so all of these smells, you know, bring on all of these memories for him. And, you know, I think he has some revelations about who he is and how he's behaving and how he's been thinking about things, treating people in his life. It's very short.
Yeah, but I think it's more than that. Again, reading it, the way I read it, something else happens at the end. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't.
Okay, you know? Tell me what that is. Maybe I'm not remembering it very well.
Well, hey, did you ever read The Diving Bell and the Butterfly?
No, I didn't.
It's, you know, it's about locked-in syndrome, which might be what Charlie has. So when she moves her eye around, wouldn't that be horrible? But then it wouldn't be that horrible, because you couldn't scream and you couldn't manifest. It would just be your mind. Like the guy who wrote it, he was the editor of French Vogue and he had the stroke. And then he wrote it because he could blink one eye, and he had a lovely nurse who did the alphabet page. But, and then he died 2 days after it was published.
Wow.
Yeah, but anyway, so I like the nurse says, it goes round and round. And we don't, no one knows whether she's in there or not in there.
Mm-hmm.
Is, you know, that's why I said horror in the introduction. But yeah, so my reading of it at the end, what happens is, just, it's not that he just gets sleepy.
Right. Yeah, it's definitely ambiguous.
Yeah, it's definitely ambiguous.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then, do you mind when someone just goes through every single story of your book?
I love it. I'm honestly, I haven't even talked about this book yet. It doesn't come out till next week, and so it's very exciting.
Well, look, I'm like giving you, you know.
You're helping. Yeah. Get ready for my book tour.
Yeah, now you can do a book tour.
Yeah. Are you? I am. I'm actually doing an in-person book tour. It's crazy.
That'd be great. So the next one. Oh, so Mansard. Do you like Mansard Roofs particularly?
I do, weirdly. I do. The reason I wrote that is that I was kind of assigned it. I was asked by the painter Lyndon Frederick to write a short story about a painting. And he sent me the painting, or he sent me an image of the painting. And it was a mansard roof at twilight, a building with a mansard roof at twilight. And I had to come up with a story. And this weirdly is what came out. The house doesn't necessarily exist, you know? So we don't actually really see it. I don't really know how the story came out, except that I had been wanting for a long time to write about that time in my mother's life when she played a lot of bridge. And so this was an opportunity.
Oh, what about the other card game, Pitch? Do you play Pitch? Did you know?
I play Pitch and I play Oh Hell. Yeah. I played Pitch with my brother a lot. Yeah. It's a great game.
Yeah. We played that. Oh Hell. Yeah. See, my mother always called it Oh Shit.
Oh, I like that better. We should call that Oh Shit. It's such a great game. I'm obsessed with Ohel, and also a game called Nerts, which nobody's heard of, but it's amazing.
The thing I don't like about mansard roofs is it's like they're not really roofs. It's just like the side. You know, it's like it's irritates me because it's saying it's something that it's really not, kind of. You know, most of it's not really the roof.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, yeah, it has a funny shape. I mean, you're being very strict about like what a roof is. You know, does it have to have a certain straight angle down?
Well, like a gable roof, all of it keeps the rain off. Yeah. But in a mansard roof, some of it's just like kind of like.
I know. Kind of like. Zoo. No, it's true. For me, they remind me of Paris. So.
Yeah. I think they're beautiful. My father used to build houses with mansard roofs.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Oh, speaking of fathers, South, there's another father.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's a trip.
What is with you and these guys?
I can't help it. I can't help it. It's the way I was raised.
My favorite line in that story is, because I have this thing about it. His country gets occupied twice during one war, and he has the nerve to bring up the Maginot Line. Because the Maginot Line was a really stupid thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, honestly, think this is going to work?
Wait, I know.
We'll just leave some spaces open. We'll just leave some spaces open.
Just go, shoop. I know. That's a funny thing. I don't know. I think war psychology, you know, is a understudied practice.
Yeah, unfortunately, everything like that reminds me of everything we're going through right now, you know? Just stupid stuff that people do because they're basically scared. Yeah,
scared. Yeah.
So, okay. We can end this interview, thankfully for you probably, by talking about the last story, which is, I look at it as kind of like your dream or your nightmare, personally.
Yeah, it's kind of like a bizarre, surreal fantasy situation where kind of all your ghosts, all your male ghosts come and haunt you.
But it's also like in the meta way, it's like a story about a story that you've written a story about.
Yeah. I'll just say yeah to that.
So have you ever had a visitation like that?
No, but it was really fun to write. It was so easy. Like the way those men just kept on coming in, you know, like the guy is kind of shape-shifting. And it was, I didn't even have to think twice about like, you know, who was next or, I don't know. It's really interesting what you hold in your imagination. And, you know, like Gerald Ford, you know, what does he mean to you? You know?
That's the thing. What I did was, I'm not technologically advanced enough to do this, and my daughter wasn't here, but it's Bing Crosby, Walt Whitman, and Gerald Ford. But Gerald Ford's only there because he was honest and truthful and all that. But so then I got three pictures and I tried to morph them together. To see what he looked like, but I can't do that stuff. But she could have done it in a minute.
That's really funny.
So try and figure out what that would look like. Someone's gonna ask you that, you know.
Well, he keeps changing, you know? It looks like all those individuals because he keeps shifting.
Yeah, I know. It's like she keeps catching him out of the corner of her eye in a way.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that made me a little queasy about the story was gin gives me a hangover anyway. And so like the idea of having a gin martini in the morning,
I know. Thinking
about it.
I know, yeah.
Why did you think of that? How did that come up?
Oh God, I have so many alcoholics in my family. I just, you know, it's hard for me not to write about alcohol, very hard. And I really have to hold myself back.
Was there one specific person that drinks gin martinis?
No, my dad drank vodka martinis though. I write a lot about vodka. I think I was mixing it up for this one.
For your coaster. So. Okay, well, so, and then the cool thing is, can I say what the last word of the book is in all caps?
Sure.
So the last word of the book is end, like Finn. I thought, this is great, because as I thought, okay, this is her writing about her, writing about her, writing about her.
Right.
I thought, okay, and yeah, that means she's done.
That story really did have to go at the very end of the book.
Yeah, I figured like, and yeah, because like, yeah, you have the three writers and you group them. And then I thought, okay, this, yeah, you don't often think.
Things are getting more surreal as you go along. Like it starts very realistic. And then you have
Mansard.
You have Mansard, and then you have Sal, you know, that has a ghost. And then you have this, which is, you know, even more surreal than all the others. So we're kind of going in a
South is
departing from reality a little bit.
Yeah. South, we didn't talk about that much, but it's very lyrical, you know? It has a very nice, has a musical quality to it.
That's the oldest story in the book, and I feel like my writing has changed a lot since then.
And you know what? I noticed that too.
Yeah.
Especially since it was sandwiched between, you know?
I talked to my editor about not including that story because it's by far my kind of least favorite. But she loved it. I mean, she just was like, no, you know, we have to include this story. And so I was like, okay.
I wouldn't say it's my least favorite. It's just that I guess maybe it did interrupt the flow to a certain extent. I don't know, except for the fact that what you're saying is right. You're going from reality to a middle section and then to like, where am I? Yeah, actually, I think it's reviewed in, you know, I always look up who's reviewed it and who's looking at it. And it was like in like a fantastic fiction review. Like, and I said, this isn't fantastic fiction. And then I realized they must have glommed on to the last couple of stories.
Wow.
I figured they would include that.
Oh, that's cool. I like that.
Well, it was really good. I mean, it was really nice because when I can remember names and stuff like that, I honestly read this a month ago because I have 4 interviews this week. And I remember it all. So, you know, a book is good if you remember the names.
Oh, that's great. Well, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for coming back again. And yeah, if you go, I'm sure your tour is all set, but I always am very lackadaisical about trying to get authors to my bookstore. But if you're ever around, that would be great.
Okay. I will come by if I am.
Okay.
Not yet, but maybe. Maybe they'll send me out again. But thank you, Sam, so much. This is really fun.
It was fun. Thank you.
Thanks. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.